Hi everyone, it's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Joining me all the way from his home base in Utah is Bryce Roberts, co-founder and managing director of a different kind of VC firm, IndieVC. He recently announced V3 of their fund model, which is focused on backing revenue-generating companies that are seeking financial independence, something different than traditional VC. Prior to starting the fund 4 years ago, Bryce invested in C-stage companies in the mid-2000s out of O'Reilly Alpha Tech Ventures, or OATV. Portfolio companies include names you'd recognize like Bitly, Chartbeat, Codecademy, Foursquare, HipCamp, OpenX, and a bunch of others. Today's podcast is all about venture capital, how it's changed, where it's going, what Bryce thinks of venture capital today. But we also get a little bit sidetracked chatting about TikTok and Bryce's coveted Twitter username. But before I jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. Do you remember a time when you started working for yourself? It was certainly no small feat, and you've been insanely busy ever since. Our friends at FreshBooks are here to make things easier for freelancers like you. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed to save you time and all those terrible administrative tasks. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds and get paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. Also, file expenses with ease to keep them perfectly organized for that lovely tax time. Go to freshbooks.com/producthunt and enter Product Hunt Radio in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. In addition to my day job at Product Hunt, I also invest in early stage startups through a fund I started. I called it Weekend Fund. At first, I was hesitant to invest in startups, worried that my time would get sucked away into back office management, LP tax reporting, and all the overhead that goes into managing a fund. Fortunately, AngelList Venture Services handle all that for me, so I can focus on finding and backing great entrepreneurs. So far, AngelList has hosted over 130 venture funds, ranging from $500,000 to several millions of dollars under management. The team is super knowledgeable, having supported hundreds of investors over the years, and eager to help fund managers plan a fundraising strategy. Once you've raised capital from LPs, you choose what startups to back, and AngelList handles the rest. If you're interested in investing in startups, take a look at angel.co/venturefunds or email me at ryan@producthunt.com and I'd be happy to help. Hey everybody, it's Ryan Hoover on Product Hunt Radio. I'm here with Bryce Roberts. We're actually doing this remotely. How's it going, Bryce?
Good. Great.
Where are you based right now?
Today I am in Salt Lake City, Utah, which is home base for me and then airports around the country when I'm not here.
And also to your 5 kids.
Yes, my 5 kids who are likely going to try to poke their head in here because they're still out of school on Christmas vacation, but we'll try to keep them at bay.
All right. We can bring them on the show if they want. We've had actually a couple babies on the show, so it wouldn't be the first to have some younger blood.
Gosh. Well, they've been online all morning recording ASMR videos. This is like the new slime videos for kids these days. And so they would love to become a little bit more internet famous.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. We'll get back to the ASMR because that's a super interesting field. So you just made an announcement recently about IndieVC. Maybe first, if you want to just dive into a little bit of your background and like, what is IndieVC? What are you doing? What was the announcement? Tell us more about that.
So I've been in the venture business one way or another for almost 2 decades now as an investor. Back in the kind of dot-com-y days, I did a few startups. The last one was purchased by Monster.com in 2001. And then I joined a local venture fund actually here in Salt Lake City, Utah, called Epic Ventures. Spent 4 years with them. And then in 2005, got connected with my now partner, Tim O'Reilly, who runs O'Reilly Media, and who at the time had a conference that they'd started, which had built from a conference to a meme to kind of a movement around this idea that they called Web 2.0. And, you know, Web 2.0, the term, we don't use it a whole lot anymore, but at the time it really captured a lot of the trends that were starting to converge in technology that kind of gave the web, you know, 2.0, it gave it its second wind after the dot-com bust. And I think as we were looking at Web 2.0, we were also starting to see that confluence of trends and technologies should also open up new channels for entrepreneurs to bring products to market. So, you know, where in the past it would have taken an entrepreneur, you know, $5 million in a Series A, selling a massive chunk of their company, going out and buying you know, Oracle licenses and Sun server, you know, Sun boxes and all this stuff, you know, we saw kind of a window of opportunity to rethink funding for startups through a playbook that has now, you know, become more mainstream. But at the time, you know, it was the kind of early days of seed investing. And so, you know, we thought that kind of company and that kind of investing wasn't just a, you know, kind of small tweak to the current model, but that there could be a whole new category, which, you know, meant different types of optionality for founders and also different structures for fund and fund returns. And so we ended up raising one of the first institutional seed funds, probably back in 2005 is when we started raising it. And we held our final close for that $50 million fund under the banner of our fund, OATV or O'Reilly Alphatech Ventures. That was in 2006 was when we held the final close on that.
Yeah. And going back to what you said about Web 2.0, like it seems like a very old term, and it kind of is, I guess, in the technology world now today. Now we're talking about Web 3.0, which is right, like driven by blockchain and all these other things. But Web 2.0, that whole movement really changed, obviously changed the internet and gave rise to like SaaS and like web-based tools. And, you know, I remember Dig back in the day too was sort of riding that wave, something that felt alive, like the internet felt more alive around Web 2.0. Like that was a huge shift in and how people use the internet. Makes it kind of exciting to think about like the next wave. Like, are we, this might be going off a little bit off track, but like, are we going to see a new wave that kind of emerges as Web 3.0 kind of comes to adoption and matures?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you look at, if you pull forward, you know, kind of the analogs from Web 2.0, I mean, you had things that were just fun, that were experimental, that when the costs were low enough, you had all of these ideas that kind of worked their way onto the web. And some of them ended up being, you know, small little acquisitions. You're talking like the Flickers and the Delicious and those kinds of things that were happening early on. And then you had some, you know, that ended up going on using those same tools, you know, to just be massive businesses, right? I mean, you're looking at, I'm thinking back to like our early pitch decks for funds one and two on OATV. And we talked a lot about like Facebook and Google and kind of what all of those meant for, you know, the web for distribution, but also for business models. Like there were things that could happen that you could start without some kind of grand plan or some crazy business model or some billion-dollar expectation from anyone because the cost to do it and experiment were so low. And, you know, I think looking at this kind of Web 3.0 world, the hope would be that, you know, they could see some of those same dynamics coming into play. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of what drove Web 2.0 was, you know, the thinking and community around open source. And I think when I look at, you know, Web 3.0, you'd hope that they're embracing and, you know, capturing a lot of those same ideals that came from that kind of that open experimental community.
And so kind of as a result of Web 2.0 and really the reduction of cost to get something out there, like we see this obviously on Product Hunt where one person can build something pretty cool in a weekend, actually. Whereas it could have taken a few decades ago, especially like multiple people and, you know, set up your own server racks and all of that. The cost to like get started is lowered. What do you, how does this kind of play into what you're doing at NDVC then?
Well, I mean, I think one of the constraints that I was starting to feel as a seed investor, so this was going back now probably 4 or 5, 6 years, was that in the early days of seed, the idea was that, you know, you could take funding that left a lot of options open for yourself and what it is you were trying to build and accomplish, right? So you could take a small seed round of funding, and with that, you could, you know, build to profitability and never raise any more money. You could have kind of a Flickr or Delicious style outcome in the kind of $20 to $50 million range that was still a meaningful return for investors, certainly life-changing money for you. And then the third was, you know, kind of there was this path that took you from a seed round to an A round and then on that kind of more traditional venture route. But as you can appreciate, having, you know, raised a seed round and then gone on to raise traditional venture, that the filter for those investments gets tighter and tighter in terms of what those fundable milestones look like, what a business and founding team has to look like to attract that kind of cash. And so, you know, I think one of the constraints I was starting to feel as we started to look at new models for supporting entrepreneurs was that even at the earliest stages, pre-product, you know, pre-revenue, all of that stuff, when it came to seed investing, you were having to essentially run them through the same filters as at the time, a Sand Hill Road VC, now a South Park VC, right? You'd have to think about, you'd have to be really clear about what this company has to be to get excited about it, to be able to fund it. And so you started to kind of get into this as a seed investor. You ended up being less experimental because ultimately you had to see in that thing, you know, an obvious path to a $1 billion business. And I think, you know, I think as a seed investor, that started to feel, you know, pretty limiting. And I think if you look at the consequences of that, you know, I think last year especially, you started to see more and more awareness of the fact that, you know, that's not necessarily healthy for the startup ecosystem in general and the tech community and world more broadly, right? I think when you start looking at the earliest stages through the lens of what's going to be fundable, then you start kind of falling back on the pattern matching that VC historically has had, right? And so if you're in it, it's a pretty easy algorithm to understand it. But if you are someone who genuinely wants to affect change and to see, you know, a community that's thriving versus a monoculture, you know, I think that was where I was starting to feel the constraints around how we were investing and what we were funding. And so part of the idea behind IndieVC was, you know, what kinds of companies, what kinds of ideas, what kinds of products, what kinds of founders could exist in the world, could have their ideas and company cultures and ideals embodied in the world through technology? How would it be different, or what would it look like if they didn't have to keep asking investors for permission to exist? Or if they didn't have to keep kind of contorting and forcing themselves into the box that looks like it has a stamp on it that says fundable, right? And so one of the ways to do that is to not need those investors, right? Or to put yourself in a position where the interactions you have with those investors are more leveraged in your favor. And so ultimately, that's what we wanted to create with IndieVC, was a kind of an investment structure in a community of founders who are focused on profitability, independence, and, you know, growing revenue, not raising their next round.
Yeah. Going back to what you said too about investing in sort of a traditional model where you, so I'm investing in early stage companies. There's always this calculation I have to consider with every investment, is that since I'm investing in pre-seed and seed stage, typically I need to make sure in most cases that they're going to be able to raise another round. As a result of that, there's sort of this factor of, I have to factor in, what is the market of other investors? Will they buy into this? And obviously I can't foresee the future, and I don't know where they'll be in 1 or 2 years, but there is this sort of risk that you take as an early stage investor, is you sort of rely in the traditional VC model on others also kind of buying into that vision and backing that company. Whereas if you're investing on the basis of, this company is going to generate revenues from day one and maybe even reach profitability or have more control over not having to raise money, then it kind of changes that risk entirely.
I think that's right. I mean, and listening to you express that, you can, you know, there's a visceral feeling that comes with that, right? Like, it's a moment that every investor has to look down and say, okay, you know, this is going to affect my decision making, whether I want to be as explicit as you are in terms of vocalizing it and recognizing it, or if you want to just say, look, this is just how it's done. But, you know, there is that dynamic where you have to acknowledge that a lot of work that's done in the earliest stages and a lot of decisions that are getting made around investments aren't necessarily getting made for wholly meritocratic reasons beyond an ability to, you know, be able to package up a story that, you know, you'll be able to sell to other investors, get other investors excited about. And, you know, that's not necessarily the driving force, and nor is that necessarily a bad thing all the time. But I do think if you look at where funding goes, right, if you look at the fact that, you know, 90% of it still goes to one gender, if you look at the fact that 75 to 80% of it still goes to essentially three cities, right? That starts to highlight the idea that if that next milestone isn't necessarily funding, like, how could you invest differently? And if you could support founders who either, you know, A, had an aversion to raising venture money because either they've been burned by it in the past, or they wanted to kind of do things that didn't necessarily fit that mold, or people who were in places or didn't look like what VCs had traditionally funded, that the best way to ensure that those ideas exist in the world, in the short term at least, is to not necessarily rely on that next kind of fundable milestone mindset that I think is more prevalent in venture maybe than we'd like to admit.
Maybe there's a lot of people here that are working on side projects, or maybe they have their own company. What advice would you give people when they're hitting that those crossroads where they're wondering, should I raise money? This is something obviously that I went through and we went through at Product Hunt, is should we raise money? Why would we raise money? Who should we raise money from? All those questions come up. I guess, what advice do you give? You know, there's always bootstrapping. There's always raising money or not. If you do raise money, of course, who should you raise from? And how do you think about that? Or what advice would you give?
That's a great question. It's one that we wrestled with a lot. And I think we still wrestle with it. I mean, when we started, we kind of viewed ourselves as that in between, right? We're not indie, right? We're not completely indie with like the middle finger up to venture and all of that stuff, but we're not.
You do have a burning unicorn on your website though, which is pretty badass, I must say.
I appreciate that. Yes, that's definitely become our unintended mascot, but people seem to love it. So it's like there's the indie mindset, but then there's also the VC mindset, which is like, you know, feeling like there's kind of only one way to build, you know, a high growth, ambitious startup. And so I guess at its most basic, like we wanted to fill the gap in between that, right? So indie VC is this idea that there are companies that could be thriving with a little bit of each of those mindsets, right? And so I think when we started, we thought we need to kind of, you know, just like in seed, where seed originally filled the gap between, you know, kind of angel funding and traditional venture funding, I think initially we started to see ourselves as like that, you know, the gap being between bootstrappers and venture funding, and that we kind of slot in there. I think, you know, as the consequences of some of this kind of growth at all cost mindset that drives a lot of the decisions in venture-backed startups has kind of shown a bit more of its, you know, a bit more of its fruit over the last year or two, I think, you know, we now see ourselves as like, you know, filling the gap between lifestyle business and monopoly, right? That we can kind of slot into a pretty big space, because, you know, I think when, you know, your question around, you know, how people should think about it. I mean, I think, you know, one, you have to think about who you are and what it is you actually want to build, right? And I think right now that the challenge we have when it comes to startups, especially people, you know, who are thinking about funding or wanting to scale up ahead of growth, you know, to grow ahead of revenue, is that, you know, we have a pretty binary decision tree right now. And that is either bootstrap it, or maybe take a little bit of angel funding, or, you know, kind of go do the venture circuit and see if you can, you know, land ideally, you know, a high caliber, high quality investor. And, you know, I think for us, we're trying to create that space in between. And, you know, but from an investor, from a founder standpoint, I mean, I think the way we start is kind of, what is it you really want to do? Like, what's success look like for you? Because some people really will only be happy if they, you know, build a massive company with billions in revenue and tens of thousands of customers or tens of thousands of employees. But I think, you know, when people are honest with themselves about what it is they want to build, you know, what we've seen is, you know, I think their idea of success oftentimes is more modest to begin with, but the venture model doesn't reward that modesty. The flip side of that is that when they've achieved that modest goal, as we've seen through some of our companies at IndieVC, it's like the ambition only grows, right? And so I think that, you know, when we advise a company, you know, we look and say, okay, are you going to have a long lag between, you know, is there a lot of heavy R&D technology development that needs to happen between today and when you can start charging customers for it? If that's the case, you're probably a better fit for traditional venture, right? If you are interested in running a business and only having it, you know, kind of tapping out at like a couple million a year in revenue, you personally get to pull a million or two off the table, that's a great business for you. I don't know that that's a great investment for us, right? And so, you know, we would advise them to, you know, either not raise at all, or, you know, raise it on super flexible, you know, terms that probably look a lot more like ours than, you know, a traditional kind of preferred equity round.
And you're also looking, you know, across the states. I don't know if you're investing outside of the US, but can you talk more about your perspective or thoughts around, you know, you mentioned earlier, most of the investments are kind of within three cities inside the US at least. Yeah. What are your thoughts around the distributed nature of startups and how are you kind of reaching into those areas?
You know, it was interesting when I actually lived in the Bay Area from 2010 to 2012. So I got started in tech and venture in Salt Lake City. We started OATV and I was living here and I moved back to, we moved to California from, for those 2 years. And when I left in 2012, you know, it obviously made some of our LPs uncomfortable that I wasn't going to be in San Francisco. And one of the things that I tried to convince them of then and that I still believe now is that, you know, organizations that have distributed DNA in them from the outset, that will end up becoming, you know, a competitive advantage or a superpower. And so I think when we look at our investing now, so that was 2012, when I look at our investing now, given that that's how we operate our own fund and have, you know, for a very, very long time, I think we've seen the pros and cons and trade-offs. And so there's probably a, from our perspective, more comfort in distributed teams. I think having gotten my start in a kind of second or third tier city like Salt Lake City has also given me the perspective that, you know, when you look at our big outcomes here, be it, you know, the Pluralsight IPO this year or the, you know, Qualtrics acquisition by SAP a few weeks ago, you know, both of those companies would not have been able to thrive at the level that they are currently thriving had they tried to run the Silicon Valley venture playbook out of Salt Lake City, Utah. And so when I look at either, you know, be it distributed teams or whether I look at, you know, some of these different geographies, it's not that they aren't as ambitious or don't necessarily have the same type of upside. It's that, you know, when you only have one playbook that wasn't written for you, it's a mistake to try to follow that. And so I think we're trying to kind of work with our companies to help them take the very best pieces of that, but not necessarily rely on it whole cloth.
Yeah. Which areas, I'm asking for myself here, which areas are you most, I guess, bullish on in terms of geographies or places where you're seeing a lot of really interesting companies or tech come from?
Well, I mean, yeah, I got started in venture in Salt Lake City back in 2001. It was a wasteland. I mean, we had, you know, the big companies back then were Novell was basically it. And when I look at Salt Lake now, I mean, it's just booming. I mean, we've got not only kind of homegrown companies like Pluralsight and Qualtrics and Domo and Freshly Picked and a bunch of those different types of companies, but then you have like, you know, SAP buying Qualtrics. They're going to make a huge investment in Utah and Salt Lake City. So I'm super bullish on Salt Lake. I'm super bullish on LA. You know, I think that LA's got a really interesting confluence of influences that are starting to happen there.
Yeah.
I look at Atlanta. You know, I think that Atlanta historically has been, it's been kind of pegged as a, you know, kind of enterprise or security type of town. But if you look at pop culture in general, you know, and you look at particularly the Black community and Black founders' influence on pop culture, like Atlanta is going to be big. And I think their influence is going to be big. I don't know if you saw the announcement of the Bevel acquisition or the Walker & Co. acquisition, but part of that is that Tristan is moving to Atlanta. And so I think, you know, I don't think one person necessarily makes the scene, but I think there's enough signal kind of happening around Atlanta and people kind of choosing to stay there and thrive there. You know, I think that's really exciting in terms of, you know, a town. A lot of stuff happening in Canada, Vancouver, Toronto, like we're paying attention to all of that in part because, you know, we as a firm, part of our thing is like we want to provide Silicon Valley resources, access, and insights without having you kind of have to move here, right? So the idea of kind of blooming where you're planted, I think is pretty core to what it is we're trying to do.
Yeah. I actually just committed to invest in my first Canadian-based company based in Toronto, actually. Yeah, I've invested really geographic agnostic, but you know, first one outside the US. And of course, there's also the aspect of valuations. Not only are valuations more expensive in Silicon Valley, but also it's more expensive to run a company in Silicon Valley. Like the talent here can be 2 to 3x, maybe 4x in some locations, more expensive. And therefore, you need to raise more money because your burn is higher. And at the end of the day, startups are kind of a combination of, one, you got to build something that people want, but it takes time.
For sure.
And the longer runway you have, the more time you have to figure it out.
You're going to get the advantage of that big Canadian tax credit.
Oh, right. That's true.
Those have a material impact on the runway for companies that are, you know, especially early stage companies.
Yeah. Yeah. I've met founders that have set up offices in Canada specifically for that reason. They're able to not only hire cheaper, but yeah, they get government grants to help with that. And it's that non-dilutive if capital is pretty nice.
For sure.
So switching gears here a little bit, what products do you love? Like, are there apps on your home screen or things that you use every day that you love? I'd love hearing more about, you know, maybe apps or productivity tools you use like at work. What can you share?
Well, you mentioned my kids early on. I have a lot of them, which means I have a lot of phones to manage around our house. And so, you know, I think especially with teenagers and little kids who are just starting to come online, you know, I think a lot of the stuff that, you know, kind of Apple did recently with their screen time has been, you know, as a parent, like hugely appreciated and is helping a lot in terms of kind of how we manage technology around our own house. I mean, you know, it's probably cliche, but, you know, we are a distributed team here for OATV and NDVC. And so we kind of live and breathe in Slack a good chunk of the day, which is, you know, ends up being maybe distracting for some, but when that's your primary channel, given proximity, like that's just been huge for us. I mean, I'm a health nerd. So I'm, you know, we were pretty early on investing in the quantified self stuff. And so, you know, I'm always kind of playing around with devices and, you know, tweaking eating habits and tracking stuff. So
are you wearing any wearables right now? Any hardware on your body?
Only I've pared back almost everything. And I just switched last year to an Apple Watch from, you know, my Garmin setup that I'd been using prior. And it's fine. I primarily use it for the fitness stuff. And given how kind of threaded together all the stuff is with the watch and the health app and all of that, it's been a great move, you know, from my standpoint. But I am looking at, I do have this kind of new headband thing that is put out by a company in Europe called Dream. I'm not a huge believer. I'm a believer in sleep. I'm not a huge believer in like quantifying sleep quality and all that stuff, because I haven't seen anybody do much helpful with any of it, but definitely something that I'm going to be experimenting with this year is trying to crack the code on sleep a little bit more.
Yeah. For those that aren't aware, describe Dream. It's a headband you wear at night. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of like a, you know, I think the URL is Dream with two E's, and it's like if you've ever seen the inside of a football helmet, like those kind of air pockets that wrap around the foam, it looks a little bit like the front of one of those. And you put that on, you connect it to an app, and that's how you sleep. I've played around with some of the like Bedit pads for your mattress, and I did a much earlier version of headbands. So we'll see. It definitely has a material impact on your love life when your spouse or significant other looks over at you wearing a headband climbing into bed. So it's not for the faint of heart. I've been married 23 years, so it's something we've been able to mutually tolerate so far.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, at some point people get over that. It's people wearing mouth guards already. So there's already different variations of non-tech products that
totally
kill your love life. But
yeah.
True relationships doesn't matter.
The other one that we've gone deep on lately has been TikTok. So I have two little girls who are completely and totally obsessed with TikTok and making videos and super depressed that they aren't completely internet sensations at this point.
What are your thoughts around your kids using technology and TikTok and things like that? Do you get nervous when they're posting videos at all? And how old are they, maybe, for the audience?
So the ones that are doing TikTok right now are, one is 8 and one is 11. But my oldest is 21, and she's had a Twitter account now for probably 10 plus years. She's that, you know, given that it's the world that I live in more than theirs, I've tried to expose them to technology early on, you know, get them involved in different services. They can see how to connect with people and ideas, but also, you know, trying to be mindful of, you know, the consequences of doing that too. So trying to, you know, both be an example to them about how to use it, and then, you know, keep open lines of communication around how they're using it, how much they're using it, all that. But overall, I think it's a net positive.
Yeah, I do too. I think if I was a parent, I would probably err more on the side of allowing my kids to use technology, and of course, trying to censor and keep them safe from some certain things. But I don't know. I think parents that don't let their kids, and maybe there's an age kind of a bar for myself too, but don't let their 12-year-old kids use technology or go on the internet, I think they're prohibiting a lot of their learning. And I think a lot of the social life, it's kind of like not being able to go to recess in some ways, you know, if you're a kid, because that's where everyone hangs out. That's where people socialize. And yeah, you should have some of that in real life too, but there's a lot of good that can come from, you know, watching YouTube videos. There's so much to learn on YouTube alone. And TikTok is an amazing platform, in my opinion, to express and learn more about creating content and videos. And, you know, there are going to be so many people who basically TikTok is their gateway into whether it's music production or video production or something like that.
Oh, I 100% agree. I mean, I think most of the parents who get really worked up about it, the reality is they, you know, probably their kids' uses of technology mirror their own a little bit way too much. It's probably a reminder to themselves that they're overusing it or not using it appropriately, or that, you know, they probably just need to be more engaged with their kids around how, when, and why they're using that stuff. I think it's a great opportunity. You know, it makes for great dinnertime conversations, driving in the car with the kids, you know, it gives us a chance to talk about how they're using it, what they're using it, what they're finding, what they're seeing, you know, how they see their friends use it, how it makes them feel. I think if you're a parent who's leaning in and engaging with your kids, I think, like you said, it is really kind of an amazing set of tools for them to get exposure to express themselves. And I think taking that away from them or being too, you know, too precious about it could really stifle some kids.
I used to actually film videos when I was a kid with my Sony Hi8 camcorder. And thank God YouTube wasn't around back then, because otherwise all these videos would be on the internet forever. But it was a fun way for me to express myself and kind of explore video production. And now it's even easier. Now kids have these phones with really amazing cameras and platforms to distribute, you know, things that they create like TikTok and YouTube and so on. It's I think going to create a whole new wave, a new generation of artists and creatives and things like that. We're already seeing that today, but just imagine 10 years from now, like the types of creators we're going to, I don't know, it's going to have a long ripple effect, I think, that we'll see in the coming ages.
Totally.
Are you on TikTok? Can I see any videos of you flossing or anything like that,
no,
Bryce?
I am not. I will not be flossing my kids. You know, I'm sure they'd love me to shout out their account and pick them up a few followers, but I'm gonna hold back on that. No one needs to see all of their, you know, slime videos and flossing videos and Orange Justice videos. So I'll spare everybody.
All right, cool. Well, where else can they find you on the internet other than TikTok?
So I'm, you know, pretty active on Twitter at Bryce, and then, you know, through IndieVC.
How'd you get that?
So my partners, Tim and Mark, had funded Ev's first company, Blogger. So Ev actually worked at O'Reilly when he moved out to the Bay Area. And so when he did Blogger, they had a chance to back him there. So we have a great relationship with him. He's been involved in a few of our OATV funds. And he was working on Odeo and talking about kind of experimenting with a bunch of other things. And that was one of them. He signed us up for accounts, and I ended up in the first name club.
Nice. You could sell that for a lot, you know.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Actually, I would argue my Instagram account gets way more offers for purchase than my Twitter account.
Are you at Bryce on Instagram as well?
I am at Bryce on Instagram too.
Nice.
Yeah, so you can find me on either of those two. Instagram is probably more family stuff, you know, just more of my own kind of photography stuff. Twitter is definitely more VC related stuff. And then pretty active on the IndieVC Twitter account, which is just at IndieVC, trying to share, you know, stories that don't necessarily conform to a lot of the traditional venture narratives we've come to accept around what's possible and not around startups.
Nice. And then if founders are, what kind of founder would you kind of classify, or for those that are maybe building a company and they're thinking about raising a venture, like who should come to you?
I would say post-revenue is one. You know, we've worked with a lot of companies at different stages, both as seed investors and then through our NDVC work. So, you know, we have found that the NDVC stuff really helps people accelerate once they have a product in market. There's no hard, fast number around revenue, but post-revenue is definitely something we look for, that they're charging somebody to validate that they have something. Looking for somebody, there isn't like an industry we're specifically targeting, but definitely somebody who shares our DNA. I mean, I think we want to find people who buy into, you know, building their company on their terms. We want to find people who have a bit of chip on their shoulder. We want to find people who have had exposure to the venture model and recognize that it's not a fit for them, that they're self-aware enough to recognize that. I mean, I think one of the things we tried to do with the launch of V3 this last week was to give people some tools to see just how expensive venture money can be and what an impact it can make on their optionality as founders if they get on that path too soon or in a less leveraged way. And so we gave people some tools to visualize kind of the NDVC path versus the traditional venture path, and the impact that has on their cap table is stark. And I don't know that enough founders are recognizing that. So, you know, when it comes to profile of founders, people who recognize the value of their own ownership, they recognize what optionality means to them, they want to keep themselves open to different kinds of scenarios and outcomes for their company, and candidly, you know, people who aren't afraid to sell, you know, people who kind of value that. You know, I think there's a certain kind of founder who just wants to be all product all the time, and I can respect that. I just don't know that, you know, that's necessarily a fit for us or who we look to fund.
Yeah, nice. Thanks for coming on, Bryce. Appreciate it. And I do want to see you on TikTok one of these days, though, so I'm going to keep pushing you.
Well, I will, as soon as I've got an account, you'll be the first to get the link.
All right. Cool. Thanks, Bryce.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.